It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon, I'm Batya Bricker, and a warm welcome to Bookmark, 101.9 Chai FM's show dedicated to books and the people who love them. What happens when writers revisit the stories we think we know? Take the Wicked Witch of the West. For generations, she was simply the villain in The Wizard of Oz. She was green-skinned, she was cackling, irredeemably evil. But then along came a novel, followed by the musical, and now the movie, called Wicked, which asked a startling question. What if we have misunderstood her all along? What if the villain, Elphaba in this case, was never the villain? And what if the story looked entirely different from the other side? That simple act of turning the narrative around has become one of the most fascinating trends in contemporary storytelling, and I am loving it. Because stories are rarely as straightforward as they first appear. History is often written by the victors. Myths tend to celebrate the heroes. Family legends smooth over those awkward bits, and we know they're there. And over time, certain versions become so familiar that we stop questioning them altogether. But 21st century writers are increasingly returning to these stories with fresh eyes. They're asking, who was left out? Who was silenced? And what might have happened if we listened to a different voice? So we are seeing revisited ancient myths, historical events, classical novels, and even beloved fairy tales from a different perspective that previous generations might have overlooked or ignored or not even been aware of. These books challenge stereotypes, they complicate heroes, they humanize villains, and they remind us that every story has more than one side. What's particularly fascinating, I think, about these books is that they tell us as much about the present as they do about the past. The questions we're asking of history or a story we thought we knew reveals what matters to us now. Issues of identity, race, gender, power, belonging, and voice have become central concerns of our age. And writers are using books or news stories as a way of exploring them. So today's show is all about books that retell the past in richer and more nuanced ways, sometimes more surprising ways. They're old stories told differently. I would love to know what you're reading. Let me know on the WhatsApp line 061 895 1019.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and this is Bookmark, Chai FM's show dedicated to books and the people who love them. Today's show is all about books that retell the past in richer, more nuanced, and sometimes more surprising ways. They're old stories, but told differently. So let's kick off with a seminal chapter in South African and world history, because this past week we commemorated 50 years since June the 16th Soweto riots in 1976. And 50 years certainly gives us the long view, a wider lens through which to revisit this terrible episode and perhaps arrive at a deeper understanding or fresh insights through different voices sharing their lived experience of history. And there's wisdom in the hindsight, and we have the sweep of history behind us. The book I want to start with is called The House at 6001, a memoir of uprising and exile. It's written by the 2024 Harvard Nieman Fellow and award-winning BBC journalist, Lebo Diseko. She started her career, she graduated from the University of the Witwatersrand and went on to become this award-winning journalist. And she turns her investigative lens inward to write a debut book that creates a definitive account of her family's legacy during the liberation struggle. So we're familiar with the story. It's June the 16th, 1976. Thousands of Black South African children take to the streets of Soweto in protest against the introduction of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction. They are met with brutal police force. Many never return home. And this pivotal day, now remembered as the start of the Soweto uprising, also reverberated in very personal ways through the walls of 6001, the house at 6001, Lebo Diseko's family home in Orlando East. So her home was a kind of backstage to the drama we all might have seen and read about. In the house at 6001, Diseko traces the intertwined lives of her parents and her aunts and her uncles who gathered and organized and resisted within that four-room Soweto house. You have banning orders and exile, late-night parties filled with music and defiance. Their story captures both the intimacy and the enormity of the South African struggle. And she draws on unsealed government documents, interviews, and her own personal journey to revisit her family's history and home. And the result is a moving memoir of resistance, of secrets, and of course, what I find the most emotional, the lasting cost of resistance, not just for those involved, but for their descendants too. And I wanted to read you a piece to give you a sense of the texture that she gives us. And this was about her and her relationship with her father, who was banned, who did eventually go into exile, who, frequently was questioned at the notorious John Foster Square, where the slip in the shower resulted in mysterious death in custody, luckily not for him. And she writes this: "When people describe my father during this time of his life, there are words that come up again and again, like integrity and commitment to the cause. He was someone you could rely on no matter what, someone who could spend his last penny to help advance the activist work that he and others were doing. That doesn't surprise me. What does surprise me are the other adjectives that people use when they speak about the person before he left the country, like fun and funny. Over and over, I'm told the same thing. He was full of laughter, the life and soul of any party, and exactly the person you'd want with you on a 10-hour drive that risked the wrath of the police. This is a world apart from my experience of him as a child. I do have flashes of warm memories, like playing aeroplane with him in the park when I was 5 and placing my 4 small feet on top of his big ones as he taught me to dance on the beat. Mostly, though, he was distant, critical, and quick to anger. He rarely shouted, but instead, his rage felt like ice cold, as he would tell me all the things I had done wrong on any particular day. My friends told me they were slightly afraid of him when they came to visit, and I was afraid of him too. Recently, I asked my dad about the 2 versions of him, the one before and the one I grew up with. And he told me that between fighting the regime and facing the challenges of exile, the trauma he experienced felt at times like it might drown him, and the pain was so great that it changed his character completely." The other book that gives us a fresh perspective of the Soweto uprising is a book called Tsitsi Mashinini, Elusive Hero of Soweto, by author Sam Mate. And it's 5 decades since the 1976 Soweto uprising that challenged South Africa forever. But little is known about its most iconic leader, the charismatic Tsitsi Mashinini. And this book goes in search of the man, a brilliantly gifted schoolboy who recited reams of poetry and excelled at debating, but who, after that fateful day in June 1976, became a hunted ringleader, a hunted man. He was identified as the ringleader in the uprising, and he went into hiding. He had to forsake his loving family, sleeping on floors, sometimes dressing as a woman to elude arrest. And eventually forced into exile, he became an international celebrity and he seemed destined for great things. But Mashanini died sick and alone, far too soon, under mysterious circumstances. And his political independence had cost him dearly. His tragic life also stands for a larger tragedy of those youths whose lives were lost or permanently derailed by their revolt against a system that denied them their humanity. So this is a colorful and comprehensive account of the man, Tsitsi Mashanini, and it sheds light on the exceptional leader, but also on the pivotal events of the 16th of June, some of which are contested to this day. So those are two books that revisit history, that start to talk about a different kind of history through a different lens. And what happens to stories that we think we know that writers revisit? And today's show is about that. It's about books that reinterpret history and mythology and historical events through a 21st century lens. My interviewee today is the award-winning Deepa Annapara, who is the author of The Last of Earth, a stunning novel set in Tibet. And it was named as one of the BBC's 12 books to read in 2026. One of the most profound things I heard her say, and it's what prompted my interview with her, is she said, "My people are not in the archive." And the book she's written gives voice not just to the official white colonial record of Tibet that we have, but the multitude of rich and diverse characters and their views of events. So that's after the break.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
My name is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. Today we are talking about rewriting stories, revisiting history or fictional narratives that we thought we knew, and looking at them through a new lens. History, as we know, is never neutral. It's shaped by who gets to tell it, how it gets remembered, and then, of course, what and who quietly disappears between the lines. But what contemporary fiction is doing now, and so brilliantly, is stepping into those spaces, reimagining familiar events, retelling a classic story, giving voice to the sidelined, the silenced, the overlooked. It's not about undoing history, but it is about deepening it and making it much more human and more layered and more true to the multiplicity of our lived experience. We could all experience an event, but from completely different vantage points. And often history is quite one-dimensional. My guest today, Deepa Annapara, does exactly that with her book. It's called The Last of Earth, and it's a riveting, expansive adventure into the heart of Tibet, with a rich array of characters, a foreign and hostile landscape. I couldn't quite believe it, actually, how hostile Tibet is, and a narrative that deeply questions what it means to understand and what it means to capture a country. Deepa, a very warm welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
She is the award-winning author of Gin Patrol on the Purple Line, which was translated into 20 languages. Her latest book is called The Last of Earth, and it is a stunning historical novel. And I know so many of you enjoy historical novels as I do. This one is set in the 19th century Tibet that follows two outsiders and their helpers as they venture into a forbidden kingdom. So it's 1869 and Tibet is closed to Europeans, which is an infuriating obstruction to subjects of the British Empire, who, as we know, want to plot and conquer. And so if they want to visit, they need to do so illicitly, really. One of these is an English captain disguised as a monk who wants to personally chart a river that runs through southern Tibet. And the other is an English woman of mixed blood, also in disguise. Denied a fellowship, of course, to the all-male Royal Geographical Society in London, but she intends to be the first European woman to reach Lhasa. And of course, for so many reasons, neither of these explorers can do it alone. And their expeditions are accompanied by, in the captain's case, Balram, who is a surveyor spy, an Indian school teacher who for several years worked for the British. And in Catherine's case, it's a guide called Manny, who pretends to be her son, and who has aspirations of being a monk himself. The intrepid adventurers and their entourages face storms and bandits, snow leopards and soldiers, fevers and frostbite. And not only that, but they have to battle their own doubts and ambitions and grief and pasts to survive this treacherous journey and country. It is quite a story. It is completely immersive. It's as rich in exploring the emotional landscape as the physical one. And to write this book, not only did Deepa do extensive research, and you'll feel that in every page, but she herself trekked through Tibet to write the story. So let's start there, Deepa. Was the real Tibet what you expected it to be?
It was. You know, I actually didn't travel to Tibet until I completed a first draft of the novel because I was afraid that the landscape would have changed so much in the intervening centuries, and especially under Chinese occupation, that it would be difficult for me to imagine what it would have looked like in 1869. But surprisingly, away from the cities, in the mountains, the landscape in many ways was familiar to me from the books that I had read for research, from the 19th century accounts of explorers, even the way in which the weather changed. You know, one minute there would be this amazing sunshine. And I remember once we were around 4,500 meters and, you know, at 4,500 meters. And then we were on this route, which was zigzagging up a mountain. And then it was sunshine. I was looking out through the window, admiring the landscape. And then suddenly it started to rain. And this was closely followed by hail. But then it was almost like a snowstorm. And so the entire landscape was covered with snow in seconds. And it was like, you know, it was summer, but it felt like winter. And then there was water pouring over the mountains. And the bus driver was really scared that, you know, we were going to go off the road.
I'm sure you were too.
I think I was just so excited seeing that exactly what I described in the book was happening. And I was just so caught up in that moment that I forgot to be afraid. You know, it hit me later that anything could have happened. But in that moment, I was just full of excitement, you know, which is, I guess maybe it's true for many writers that you write something, it's from your imagination, but then it actually comes true.
Wow, it's just so evocative. And I was intrigued to hear you talk about the personal relationship that Tibetans have with the landscape. It's such a different way of, you know, as Westerners, we relate to the landscape almost as it's wallpaper. It's like in the background. You don't really have a relationship with it. It just provides the context for your life. But Tibetans don't think like that and they don't speak like that. Even the words they use conveys that. Can you tell us a little more?
It was surprising to me in many ways, even though I grew up in India, and we do have that different relationship with the landscape in that, you know, our gods, for Hindu gods, are always residing on top of mountains. I remember a guide pointing this out to me that, you know, why are your gods so up at these elevations? You always have to trek to get to them. They're not accessible readily in many places. So there is a relationship where, so for instance, in the state that I'm from, which is Kerala, we don't cut down trees around certain groves. They're considered sacred groves. So, you know, there is sacredness attributed to certain places. But I saw more of that in Tibet today. And I was thinking especially about that contrast between how many Westerners approached, you know, these landscape, because it was always with the idea of conquest, of controlling the landscape. So the very act of cartography was about representing the landscape, you know, kind of cutting it down into pieces, presenting it in this very flattened way in which you could understand it, but also a way in which you could control it. You know, you could figure out how many people you could tax, what resources could be exploited. So the Westerners' approach to the landscape, especially in the 19th century, was really about conquering, controlling that landscape. Whereas with a number of people From India and from Tibet, their idea would be about the landscape would be very different. They had an understanding that the natural world could not be controlled. And I think we are seeing that today, isn't it, in terms of climate change. And what we are understanding is that we think we can control or, we can regulate what happens. But really, if you don't respect nature, that's not how events eventually turn out. So for Tibetans, because they have this, relationship with the landscape that's based around divinity and spirituality, and because it's a very familial relationship. So as I've said in other places before, they call their lakes, it's always, there's a prefix like a sister, mother, or brother attached to the name of every lake and river and mountain. So it's a relationship when you see someone as part of your kin, and then you don't really, you try not to hurt or damage them in any way. Whereas the Westerner at that time would have been going in with the idea of, how can I control this river or cross this river, or how can I use this to, say, send down soldiers or food.
It's such a vastly different way of moving through the world. And it made me think about this Western view that for something to have value, you have to have it measured or weighed or quantified in some way. And that's why we're obsessed with things like maps still. And we often make the assumption that a map is accurate. I mean, I know, they are dynamic. We know this because of geopolitics, etc. But even the maps we have that are so-called accurate are filtered through money or through politics or through the lens of the people measuring the landscape.
Absolutely. So, today it's much more well known that the Mercator's projection, on which a lot of the maps are made to this day, is quite inaccurate in that if you look at the size of countries in the West, they appear to be much bigger than their actual size. And there are places online where you can go and see what's the actual geographical landscape of Nigeria and compare it to what it is on the map. You can see that it will be much smaller on the map that we use even today.
Really?
So yes, you can. There is, I mean, I forget the
Wow.
name of the website, but there is a website that shows you. You can compare the size of the United Kingdom with a country in Africa, and you'll see that the country in Africa is much smaller. So these maps, because we rely on a lot of the original maps from the 19th century, and those maps were really curated to create this view that the Western world is superior. And so you have countries in Africa and Asia looking up to the metropole, which was often England and London at that time. So there were subtle ways and not so subtle ways in which maps were used for propaganda. And I think we keep forgetting that. One of the interesting things, I think, especially South Asian historical fiction writers, what they've done is to look at those relationships that have continued despite the borders that often the British drew between various South Asian countries, such as India and Pakistan, and India and what is today Bangladesh. So when those lines were drawn, they didn't take into account the relationships that had existed between, both sides of the border for several centuries. And they have continued despite the borders as well, despite the fact that, for instance, it's not easy for someone from India. I mean, it's almost impossible today to travel to Pakistan and actually then come back to India. Even if, like me, you have a different passport, just traveling to Pakistan would essentially mean that it puts you on a kind of blacklist that stops you from entering India. But there are still relationships and understanding that exists beyond those borders, which maps can't actually capture accurately. And I think that is something that's interesting about cartography, which, several South Asian writers have tried to explore in their novels.
Maps aside, the history itself, the only record we might have of a historical event is through the, say, British white male explorer. And you said something that I found so piercing and poignant. You said, "My people are not in the archives." And part of writing this book was about putting your people and perhaps other people as well, but just different voices into a history that we thought already existed. I know you bear this responsibility. Can you talk to us about that?
So the archives of that are there about Indian history, essentially any historical record, it has been curated by the British who were ruling India at that time. So they left India only in 1947. So for nearly two centuries, the records that we have access to are written from a very British point of view. And what that point of view does is to present a very imperialistic idea, and it negates the idea that Indians had any agency or that they were even fighting against imperialism and had certain ideas about their own autonomy. So we don't see that in the records, because even when they were uprisings against the British, they were essentially portrayed as something which was spontaneous, almost like terrorist activity. So the archives were in some ways propaganda material. And if you are reading it as someone from the subcontinent, as I am, and trying to see what were the motivations of Indians, or, you know, what were they doing on a day-to-day basis, it's very hard to see that in the archives because it's not there. So in this very specific case, when I was looking into the Indian spies and surveyors who worked in Tibet for the British, all the documents have been written by the English officers at the Survey of India. And what we don't see is anything that represents the Indian consciousness. What were their motivations? What were their struggles? We don't understand any of that. It's mostly written by the British officer who is compiling the information that the Indians brought back from Tibet. The only document I could find written by an Indian was by an Indian explorer named Nain Singh Rawat. And he had, he had this route map and very rudimentary details about the distances that he traveled and whether he encountered a storm or what was the altitude. But there's nothing in it about his own experience, which he didn't put down in writing. So part of the challenge as a fiction writer is to understand what would have motivated someone like him or the character of Balaram to actually travel to Tibet on this very hostile mission and betray the Tibetans, with whom he had much more cultural affinity than the British. So that is always a challenge for both the Indian historian and the writer writing about that particular time period.
There's a lot of moral complexity in a lot of the characters, and I really enjoyed that because I think we all grapple with some really difficult and complex, and almost there is no right answer here. You know, you kind of balancing two ideas or even three ideas at the same time. One of them is what I really enjoyed seeing was the idea of racism and how racism permeates all the different characters in different ways. I mean, one of the really memorable ones was Catherine, who is she's of mixed race herself, and she comes into contact with a character, Chetak, and she's attracted to him, and there's some kind of energy between them, and he rejects her in some way, or he doesn't respond to her advances, and she thinks to kind of make herself better, she says, "What right did a mere name have to even consider such a spiteful thing about me?" She kind of justifies her own feelings within her racism. But there's also racism between the helpers, between the different castes. It's complicated.
It is to this day in India. There are so many differences based on caste and class. The differences of caste perhaps are more evident when you move away from cities, where people who are considered to be part of lower caste still can't drink from the same wells or draw water from the same well or go to the same schools. Or in some cases, the men are not allowed to grow a mustache. And we still hear these cases about how someone has been attacked because they dared to go against what the upper class had demanded. So constitutionally, this is all illegal because the Indian Constitution guarantees everyone the same rights. But in practice, this is not followed, especially away from cities and towns. So when you move into the more rural areas, you'll see that the very rigid forms of caste rules that existed 2 centuries ago are still in place. And caste comes into play even in cities when you look at who has power and say in a newsroom, in the media, these are still dominated by the upper caste. So this is an issue that's true to this day. And then when you add on to that this layer of colonialism and the ways in which the British try to make Indians feel inferior and as second-class citizens in their own country, that creates another layer. And I think a lot of these racist discriminatory ideas have been internalized by Indians because we're still, for instance, just as an example, we're still obsessed about complexion and the color of one's skin. And if you're fairer, then it is seen as an advantage as opposed to, brown skin, which can also point to the fact that you are a person from the lower caste. So when I was writing this novel, I was interested in thinking about all those ways in which one part of us, we can understand, may be able to understand that these ideas are wrong. But at the same time, culturally growing up from childhood, you have imbibed these ideas, you've heard it all around you, and it would still play a part in how you look at people. So this is what I try to portray in the novel. In Catherine's case, she is biracial, but what was interesting to me was, I was reading these women's accounts of traveling, especially through Tibet at that time, and also these, other accounts of women explorers from the 19th century. I can't say I found any account in which they of a mixed race, excuse me, mixed race female explorer. But at the same time, I thought that as women, they would have a better understanding of what racial discrimination or might be doing to, or how it is wrong, or how it affects, say, people in India. But what I found was that they really upheld imperialist ideas and viewpoints. And in fact, they could be much more, discriminatory in their portrayal of Indians. So even though they didn't have freedoms, say in London, and they were running away from the constructions of Victorian society, in many ways it didn't make them more sympathetic towards the causes of Indians and others.
It's fascinating, just moral complexity. And I think that's something that we all have to face within ourselves. We all have shades of that, of our upbringing, of thinking that's been planted, that we almost can't separate ourselves or our own thinking from ideas that maybe we don't want anymore or have become outdated or no longer serve us. If you want to read a book that talks about all these things, colonialism, racism, gender, but also about humanity and what it means to take a treacherous journey into yourself and across a wild land. If you want to see Tibet through pages, but also feel it and smell it, get a sense of its rich and complex past and present, but also immerse yourself in a riveting narrative that keeps you gripped to the end, this book is a must. The Last of Earth by Deepa Anapara is available now at all good bookstores. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and this is Bookmark. Today, we've been exploring histories, stories that are revisited, that have been viewed through a completely fresh and different lens. And I'd like to highlight what I think is not just a must-read of the month, but of, I don't know, the year. It's not just of the week and not just of the month. It is an exceptional book. It's called Fagin the Thief by Alison Epstein. And you were not going to find it at all bookstores. Exclusive Books Hyde Park have stock, and you will find it online, but it's certainly worth getting. Fagin the Thief is a witty, wicked, and thrilling reimagining of Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist. And instead of that classic villain we know, that anti-Semitic stereotype that's become famous the world over, Fagin, we finally have the retelling that reclaims the humanity of Fagin. So long before Oliver Twist stumbles onto the scene, there's Jacob Fagin, and he's scratching out a living, a life for himself in the dark alleys of 19th century London. He's born in the Jewish enclave of Stepney, and shortly after his own father was executed as a thief, Jacob and his very open-minded but traditional mother, Leah, are each other's whole world. But then Jacob's prospects are forever altered when a light-fingered pickpocket takes Jacob under his wing and teaches him a trade that pays far better than the neighborhood boys could possibly dream. And he looks at his mother, who slaves away in candlelight as a seamstress, like so many of them were, trying to eke out a living, versus the life of a pickpocket, which was actually much more lucrative than he could ever imagine. And he thinks to himself, there's a very moving scene where he thinks, you know, it's easier to be Fagin the thief than it is to be Fagin the Jew. So Jacob strikes out on his own. He familiarizes himself with London's highest value neighborhoods while forging his own path in the shadows. But everything then changes when he adopts an aspiring teenage thief, and you will know the name, Bill Sykes, whose mercurial temper poses a danger to himself and anyone else foolish to cross him. Along the way, we meet Jacob's extended and really chosen found family, which expands to include his closest friend Nancy and his greatest protege, the Artful Dodger, which will all be familiar to you from Oliver Twist. But as Bill's ambition soars and a major robbery goes awry, Jacob is forced to decide what he really stands for and what a life is worth. The book immerses you in Dickensian England, and I wanted to read you a piece because it's really a slice of history, but also a slice of Oliver Twist that we never actually see behind the scenes. Jacob glances down and reads the headline. Jewish Disabilities Bill enters second week of debate in the House of Lords. Initial vote on Rothschild swearing in to be called. Just by the way, the Jewish Disabilities Bill was the controversy around Baron de Rothschild before he was Lionel de Rothschild, before he was sworn in, as to whether he could use the Christian Bible to be sworn into the House of Lords. That's what the Jewish Disabilities Bill was all about. And Jacob says, there's no need to read further. He creases the paper sharply. Unlike Bill, who never spares a thought for anything that doesn't directly concern him, Jacob uses his time between thefts to listen and is well aware of the genteel debate currently underway in Westminster. Baron Lionel de Rothschild was elected to represent the City of London in the House of Commons months ago, and ever since, Parliament has been thrown into a bureaucratic storm over whether a Jew must take the oath of office on a Christian Bible or the Old Testament, and whether the Old Testament would be equally binding. The caustically polite tenor of the debate gives the whole matter an air of farce. And that's the context in which the story happens. Just by the way, in case you are interested, Baron de Rothschild does eventually swear in 1858 on the Hebrew Bible, and he substitutes the phrase "upon the true faith of a Christian" for "so help me God." And that's just an aside. But the book it's colorfully written. It's unforgettable. It's wickedly funny. And what Epstein does for Fagin is what Wicked did for The Wicked Witch of the West. It's an outstanding read, winner of the Jewish Book Council Award for Fiction. And finally, we have the real story of the infamous Jacob Fagin, London's most gifted pickpocket, liar, and rogue, but also sympathetic character trying to make his way in the world, as we all are.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
There's one book that I did not manage to talk about, and I'd love to get your opinion on it because it's written by Maggie O'Farrell. It's her new book called Land. Maggie O'Farrell is the author of the award-winning Hamnet, which we know from the most recent movie, but also, of course, award-winning book, and other books like The Marriage Contract. And what she's done with this book is she's returned to her own Irish roots and reconsidered her heritage and written a book about identity, about mapping, and the traditional castings of modern versus the outdated. It's a book called Land. And it starts off with the windswept peninsula stretching out into the Atlantic. And we meet Thomas and his reluctant son, Liam, who are working for the Great Ordnance Survey project to map the whole of Ireland. The year is 1865, and it's in a country not long since ravaged and emptied by the Great Hunger, by the Great Potato Famine. And so I only started this book. I haven't read beyond 50 pages. And I'd love your opinion. If you've read it or you are about to read it, I'd love to hear. If you enjoyed it, if it was worth reading. I found the beginning so incredibly sad, the descriptions of the Great Hunger, of the potato famine, so desperate and so dire that I had to put it down. But I know that with Maggie O'Farrell, the writing is going to be brilliant and the book is likely to be really, really good. So let me know, even offline or on the WhatsApp line, and the message will be sent through to me even if the show is finished. I would love to hear, because the reviews have been excellent, that it's a spellbinding story of separation, of longing, of recovery, and of course revisiting the story of the Irish people through a different lens. So I would love to hear what you think. Today's show was all about revisiting stories we thought we knew, or rewriting history. We reconsidered the seminal Soweto riots of 1976. We explored The House at 6001 by Lebo Diseko, and the other book, Tsitsi Mashinini, Elusive Hero of Soweto, by Sam Mate. We reviewed the colonial past of Tibet with the immersive The Last of Earth and Deepa Anapara. And we ended with a story we thought we knew and completely revisited, called Fagin the Thief, Alison Epstein's retake on the famous, infamous anti-Semitic trope or character of Fagin. Next week's show is, all I can say is that it's offbeat. It's about the cool kids of the literary world, the quirky, the sexy, the stylish, the unconventional, books with attitude, books with edge, books that break the rules and remind us that reading can be every bit as fashionable and surprising and seductive as every other art form. So if you're thinking of expanding your usual repertoire, and many of you have discussed this with me, it's something that we all try to do, or if you've ever picked up a book and thought, I've never read anything like this before, then this show is going to be for you. We're going to be chatting to Sven Axelrad, who is the new darling and the coolest kid of South African fiction at the moment. And we'll be reviewing a host of books that have enough style and enough swagger to make you sit up and take notice. So goodbye for now, and happy reading.